Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, the United Nations is coordinating 16 different peacekeeping operations in hotspots around the world. Today, we'll look at the effectiveness of those peacekeeping operations with a world leader who's led the effort to reform the UN's operations in this area and one who's experienced peacekeeping efforts firsthand. José Ramos Horta has been an internationally known opposition leader to the Indonesian occupation of East Timor, which took place in 1975, and continued through 1999. He was named the 1996 Nobel Peace Prize laureate for his eloquent opposition to Indonesia's then systematic oppression of his people. In 1999, after a UN-sponsored referendum resulted in the people of East Timor voting for independence, an Indonesian-sponsored militia group launched a scorched-earth campaign across the country, devastating over 85% of the capital city, which only ended with the intervention of an international force led by Australia. Eventually, East Timor, in 2002, became the country of Timor-Leste. My guest today, Mr. Ramos Horta, has served as a foreign minister, a prime minister, then president of the republic from 2007 to 2012. Since his term, he's taken on a variety of assignments on behalf of the UN, most recently as chair of the high-level independent panel on UN peace operations. That panel have submitted a major report with four major emphases at the end of last year. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, and I spoke with him while he was here. José Ramos Horta, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
You are chair of the UN High-Level Independent Panel on UN Peace Operations and looking at how the UN does peacekeeping, and I guess there are, 16 active peacekeeping missions from the UN today and looking at exactly how they change. Before we talk about that, talk about how UN peacekeeping affected your young country of Timor-Leste.
Obviously, the UN role in my country, like in many former European colonies in Africa, is very mixed. When you have in the country concern a national leadership, an elite that is politically united, responsible, mature, that engage in dialogue with each other to settle differences, then it is easy for the UN, because the UN cannot, and no country can impose on people, a community, a country, rules and regulations and political decisions when there is no national political unity, political will. In the case of Timor-Leste, when situation allowed for the UN to be involved, and that was only in 1999. In the previous 24 years, the UN was completely absent from the situation.
Was that because the UN considered what was then called East Timor to be a part of Indonesia and an internal issue?
No, it has more to do with the fact that Indonesia never agreed, would allow any modicum of UN presence in the country. They didn't want impartial international observers, they didn't want any witnesses to the barbarities that were unfolding there. That's the behavior of many regimes around the world. But the world changed. There was economic financial crisis in Indonesia. The regime of General Suharto collapsed. There was openness. And it was then that the Indonesia agreed to hold a referendum, allow the United Nations in. By then, over the years, we developed a national leadership, a national resistance movement that also were very strongly supported by the Catholic Church, because my country is 97-98% Catholic. So we very much a cohesive nation, 97-98% Catholic.
As a part of a country that is overwhelmingly Islamic.
Exactly, yeah. And although the conflict was never of religious or ethnic nature, it was political, it was a decision by the then president of Indonesia in 1975 to invade, hoping that it would be easy to acquire another piece of land to adapt to the vast archipelago of Indonesia. They didn't expect that we would fight back in many different ways, including internationally. I was the international face of the struggle in the United Nations, New York, in Washington, in Europe, all over the world, and were able to build a network of friends, supporters, including in the U.S. Congress, I have to say, if any institution contributed most to our freedom, would be the U.S. Congress, because there are great people in the U.S. Congress who never relented in their support to us.
And you make a point of saying Congress as opposed to the administration. Would the administration felt like it had to deal with Indonesia more as a partner than a separatist group?
Yes, the U.S. Was confronted in 1975 with a post-Vietnam syndrome. The U.S., you know, was forced to leave Vietnam in humiliation. And then you have the whole region paranoid about advances of communism. So then, to aggravate situation for us, absolutely zero knowledge about the country. So only few people in the Congress who are very curious, very well informed, like former senator, congressman Tom Harkin of Iowa, or congressman Tony Hall of Ohio, or congressman Frank Wolf, a Republican of Virginia. We had so many people, Republican and Democrat, that were won over for our struggle. But also the U.S. Bishops Conference. Every time we needed a targeted action, we would call on the U.S. Bishops Conference, and then they would send a letter to the U.S. Congress, to the U.S. President. But that was incredible patient work over the years. So finally, the UN came in 1999, and they did a remarkable job in extremely difficult circumstances of security problems posed by Indonesia.
And I was going to say, in the wake of the plebiscite, you had these militia elements.
Yes.
Were they actually from Indonesia, or were they a disaffected minority within Timor?
There were many who were Timorese, but also many Indonesian police elements, army elements, disguised as Timorese militia. They were not. And they went on a rampage.
They really raised many of much of the country's infrastructure.
Exactly. 80% of the capital was totally burned down. And 70% of the infrastructure around the country, schools, public buildings, clinics, and uprooted 300,000 people.
Now, was the UN on the ground at that point?
At the point, we had a very small UN civilian mission there that had been there to organize and supervise the referendum. There were not a single armed UN officer there. And yet they behave with admirable courage, with dignity, in the face of the violence. And luckily, at that time in the U.S., we had a great president, Bill Clinton, very sensitive, compassionate, who responded to American U.S. outcry, U.S. Congress outcry, to the world outcry from Europe to Australia, and people, individuals, you know, by the hundreds of thousands all over the world, protested the violence there. So finally, under U.S. Moral political leadership, in support of U.N. action and putting pressure on Indonesia, the new president, they allow in an international force.
And how did that international force, once they got there, were they helpful?
Yes, the international force immediately put an end to the rampage, and but also in agreement with Indonesia, because Indonesia had a very important functioning army on the ground. That army, under the agreement with the UN, under pressure from the US, Indonesia withdrew its forces, replaced by an international force authorized by the Security Council and led by Australia. So the militia, the gangs, they all packed and left the country. There was still some trouble in the beginning, some remnants of the militia creating problems, but by and large, by the time the international forces landed on the ground, the militias had began to withdraw from the territory.
That sounds like a success story, really.
Yes, I would say a success story, because there was an international united political will. But also there was a responsible country, Indonesia. Indonesia is not South Sudan. Indonesia was not Iraq or Syria under Assad. They are proud of their role in the world, their image. It's a country of 250 million now, extremely important in the region. proud of its history, proud of its role in the United Nations system, so they cooperated and vacated the territory. So there was a very good, productive, constructive cooperation between the international forces and the departing Indonesian forces.
It sounds like that's too often not the case in our current peacekeeping operations. My guest today is Jose Ramos Horta, the former president of Timor-Leste. He chaired a recent UN high-level independent panel on UN peace operations. They submitted a report to the United Nations in 2015. He's also a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, and he was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations talking about what needs to change and how U.S. peace operations and UN peace operations are working. How has the role of peacekeeping changed from the UN perspective, say, from 20, 25 years ago to today? Has it changed a great deal?
It has changed in many ways, in the sense that in the past, the so-called peacekeeping were deployed in order simply to maintain the peace, to observe, to monitor a peace agreement that had been agreed by the belligerent parties, like in the Sinai, you know, Israel, Egypt, and other Arab countries.
So there's a conflict, the parties come to a ceasefire, yeah. Some sort of, if not a permanent peace, at least a truce at that point, and then peacekeeping forces come in to separate the two parties to maintain peace.
Yeah, and that's the concept, the notion of peacekeeping. But since then, in the last 20 years or so, the last 10 years, the doctrine has evolved into a proactive UN intervention to prevent genocide. In some occasions, as in Rwanda, it miserably failed to prevent the genocide there. And because of Rwanda, the doctrine evolved into the duty to protect, the obligation to protect, the R2P, the right to protect civilian population. When there are indications that a particular regime in a particular country is either willingly engaged in committing atrocities or is unable to because it's fragile, it lost control, and the people are being killed, then there is an obligation on the part of the international community to step in, authorized obviously by the Security Council, deploying forces that upon landing, they would engage any element, any group that threatening civilian population. So that's in theory this. But this is theory, this is the principle. It runs often against much opposition. For instance, if we talk about early UN intervention to prevent a conflict, voices immediately arise in the UN that this is like a window, a door opening for regime change. Look at what happened in Libya, in Benghazi, when there was talk about preventing bloodbath in Benghazi.
So preventing a conflict from getting started is seen to some parts of the UN as taking a side.
Take a side, yes.
And not being a neutral arbiter.
Yes, exactly. And Libya is one of the sad examples where the Security Council, with China and Russia agreeing to it, authorized a UN force, international intervention, to prevent Gaddafi forces from marching towards Benghazi and slaughter civilian population. Well, as it turned out, yes, they stopped Gaddafi forces from entering Benghazi, but then they took a step further. They fired missiles into a convoy where Gaddafi was on, trying to flee Tripoli. He was killed, so there was regime change. Since then, the Russians and Chinese are saying no more repetition of the Libya precedent to allow the Security Council to be dragged into regime change situation.
That was an example where you had agreement to basically stop bloodshed, to stop an active conflict between two warring parties, dissidents and the Gaddafi regime. But what happened, the events of the moment took the next step, which did not have that full agreement of the body.
Yeah, even if there had been full agreement of the Security Council, to deploy troops throughout Libya. The country is far too large. It was always tribal. Gaddafi never really bothered in building institutions of the functioning state. He always ruled as a big tribal
power
chief.
Personality. Yeah,
he has a personality. So the UN would be bogged down in Libya, as it is bogged down in South Sudan right now. And people have harsh criticisms of the United Nations in South Sudan, for instance. But I would say if the UN were not in South Sudan, situation would be far worse. It has not solved the problem. It has not put an end to the violence, to the almost genocide there. But many hundreds of thousands more would have been killed. For all the faults, the fragilities, the failures of the UN, it is better being there to save few lives than being completely absent when people are being killed. And the problem when we deal with South Sudan and Congo and others is the role of neighbors. Are the neighbors of these countries contributing to peace? They are part of solution, or they are actually part of the ongoing problem?
Right. And oftentimes in Africa, everybody's a proxy for somebody else.
Exactly. Yeah. They have, particularly in the sub-Saharan Africa, you have borders inherited from the Europeans that split communities, ethnic groups in two, three different sides of the border. And sometimes out of ethnicity, allegiance, solidarity, out of economic, mineral interests, their neighbors intervene. Congo is a good example of how neighbors are not really very helpful in ending the violence there.
It seems to me that any nation would have a vested interest in having stable neighbors. Do you think that in the case of sub-Saharan Africa, these borders are so sort of artificially created that there's no strong sense of nation states for these things, so that they would naturally want stable neighbors?
Africans obviously accepted the artificiality of their borders. There is no way of turning back. It would be even worse, probably. The problem has also to do with the capacity of the state to extend its authority throughout the territory. Look at Mali, huge country, stretched thousands of miles along the coast. And the state, the government is poor. Its armed forces can hardly not even keep a small town protected, let alone extending state authority throughout the entire country.
Well, I was going to say the West often looks with this sort of measure of superiority towards some of these countries. We forget that Western Europe, it took 1,400 years to sort out borders with endless wars for 1,400 years before we found, and there's still conflicts over borders today.
Yeah.
They're, for the most part, peaceful.
Yes, exactly. So even in spite of the problems of South Sudan, that is abominable, to some extent the problem of Congo is millions and millions have been slaughtered over the last 10, 15 years, millions, far more than Syria. And the South Sudan is far worse than the situation in Syria in terms of numbers of people killed, the brutality exacted on women and children. But Sudan and Congo do not occupy too much of international attention. It is Syria that occupy most of the attention, because that's where most of the international media is focusing on, because they literally border Europe and is a major security challenge for Europe with the influx of millions of refugees. So they pay attention to that. But even with international attention focused on Syria, tremendous efforts by the U.S. administration and others, well, the problem boils down to what I always have said throughout our panel's work, throughout my own career: when there is lack of political will, political wisdom, when there is lack of leaders who have a vision and commitment to peace, no outside force can resolve. In Syria, all sides fail. The opposition itself, they completely overestimated themselves, completely underestimated President Assad. For Assad, it's the very survival of his people, of himself and the Alawite minority group. Assad even was warning 5 years ago about extremist ideologies, religions, as part of the so-called opposition. The West, particularly France and the UK, euphoric about Libya, thought it would be easy to also bring down Assad. Well, so everyone estimated each other, overestimated each other. And that's why I say, do not ever underestimate your adversary. Do not ever overestimate your chances. Both lead to abject failure. And this is what's happening in Syria, and I don't see how this can be resolved anytime soon.
My guest today is former president of Timor-Leste, José Ramos Horta, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate. He was chair of the United Nations High-Level Independent Panel on UN Peace Operations. And your report, one of the first essential shifts you said needed to occur in your commission, was that politics must drive the design and implementation of peace operations. That's what you're exactly talking about right there.
Yes, we have emphasized, based on our cumulative experiences of the UN and the panel members, we have 17 panel members. Between us, we had 600 years of experience in all kinds of variety of field. We consensually argue that the UN, in deciding a peace operations, must have a clear political strategy. Why it is getting involved, how long it is going to be in a place, how it's going to get out, and there has to be a well-integrated process. Yes, secure the place through credible, well-resourced, well-trained security forces that are credible in the eyes of the belligerents. You impose security and protect civilian population the moment you land. But at the same time, you have an ongoing process of political efforts to engage all parties in dialogue, working with the rest of the international community to consolidate the security gains that gradually you have in the country and support the national actors in dialogue and the nation and the state building. But this is a tall order. This requires long-term vision, long-term planning. There cannot be quick fixes that the UN was used to. Quick fixes means once you depart, the whole country fall into conflict again. Throughout our panel work, we receive reports of misbehavior by peacekeepers, of poor training, deficit in training and equipment, etc., etc.
And in small cases, if I may interrupt, it's ended in more misery on the local residents because you've seen sexual exploitation by some fraction of peacekeeping forces, and just adding to the misery as opposed to alleviating.
Exactly, yeah. And it's a tragedy, you know, coming from where I come, a country that was at the receiving end of violence in the past, and later at the receiving end of benefit from the UN, because in my country, the UN in general, peacekeepers, police, behave admirably well. There were few occasional incidents of indiscipline, but this to be expected when you're dealing with thousands of young men from different nationalities deployed in a country. But overall, the UN did very well there. But in other situations, look at the situation in South Sudan recently, when there was a major wave of violence, the UN was incapable or unwilling to protect people. Maybe it was, I wouldn't say it is unwilling, enough, but that's what the report say. It was huge, the disappointment.
Or unable.
Unable, because the country is huge, and the forces are overstretched. And I kept warning throughout our report, the UN cannot allow itself to be dragged into every conflict in the world unless there is strong political will on the part of the international community, unless everybody provide the best possible troops, equipment, stand behind the troops with strong political united front, because otherwise, like the UN overstretched, no more than 100,000 UN troops, mostly in the African continent, 70% are on the African continent. And not all are equal in terms of training, in terms of resources they have. And I said, you know, when empires, and the UN look like an empire, overstretch, you collapse. So it's better that Security Council take a look seriously at each case and decide whether the UN is the best institution to be deployed, or better to have a coalition of the willing countries authorized by the UN Security Council that are the first responders to a conflict situation. Like if you have American troops, British, South African, Ethiopian, that part of the so-called coalition of the willing, with their own troops, their own equipment, under single command, highly trained, with highly mobile, with helicopters, gunships, and so on, they can control the situation. And then on a second stage come the more traditional peacekeepers. That is a solution. But the so-called coalition of the willing is a nationally funded operation. That's when some of resistance comes in.
Now, one of your recommendations getting along to this idea of this well-trained force is clarity is needed on the when to use force, on the use of force. I can remember back in the Balkans, you know, there were atrocities that were occurring just down the road from where a peacekeeping force was. And when the commander of the peacekeeping says, well, I didn't consider it part of my orders because there was no clarity on what they were supposed to do, how they're supposed to intervene. I guess that's a major, major component.
Exactly. This is what happened in the Balkans. It happened in Bosnia. It happened in Rwanda prior to the, during the genocide. UN forces were there. But orders from New York, including from the then Secretary General, Under Secretary General for Peacekeeping Operations, Kofi Annan, who later became UN Secretary General, Nobel Peace Prize winner, was to instruct the UN in Rwanda to lay low. And so the UN completely lost credibility in Rwanda. And Rwanda was a case in point that it could have been prevented if actions had been taken earlier by the Security Council to double the forces there and to intervene in a forceful way against those elements that were committing, but already committing barbarities.
You submitted these proposals, your panel submitted them in 2015. Has there been any sort of movement from the UN very quickly on these recommendations?
Not really. Another panel was set up by the Secretary General to review our recommendation and begin the process of implementation. But everything mostly has been on hold until the election of the new Secretary General of the United Nations. Current one ends his mission in December. A new one will be, we will know, by October this year. So it will be him or her who will have to undertake the implementation of our recommendations and of two other major reports on women, peace and security and peace building architecture on how the UN can be more effective in peace building once security has been guaranteed secure in a particular place. So there are really three major reports on the table for the new Secretary General to show leadership, commitment, and undertake implementation of all the recommendations contained in the three reports.
Jose Ramos Horta, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. God bless you.
Jose Ramos Horta, the former president of Timor-Leste and the chair of the United Nations High-Level Independent Panel on UN Peace Operations, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. The 1996 Nobel Peace Prize laureate was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.